This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In June, Governor Peter Shumlin signed Act 64 into law. This is the bill that aims to direct the cleanup of Lake Champlain and other Vermont water bodies. It's a wide-ranging law, and as part of it, the Agency of Agriculture is changing some AAPs. Those are accepted agricultural practices, and they're changing them to RAPs, required agricultural practices. What that means is that even small farms will be subject to regulation and enforcement from the Ag Agency on certain anti-pollution measures. But those RAPs aren't set in stone yet. We're nearing the end of the public comment period, which wraps up next Friday. Farmers have been sharing their views. Excuse me and apologies for the cold. Farmers have been sharing their views on what's doable and what looks really onerous or expensive for them. And today on the program, we're going to be joined by Chuck Ross, Secretary of the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food and Markets, and by Laura DiPietro, Deputy Director of the agency's Agricultural Resource Management Division. They're going to guide us through what's likely to be in the final wording of the new rules, and they'll answer any questions you might have. Welcome to the program, Secretary Ross and Laura DiPietro. Nice to have you.
Great to be here, Jane.
Thank you.
Yes, and you're probably very glad that you're in our Montpelier studio and I'm in our Colchester studio. No germs to be exchanged. This can be very complicated. So can you sort of give us the overview here first? What is changing and what is not changing from accepted agricultural practices to required agricultural practices? I don't know, Laura or Chuck Ross, which one of you is best for that?
Maybe we'll do a
tag team.
Tag team this. I think it's first important to understand that the AAPs have always been required of all people engaged in agricultural practices in the state. So the RAPs are required also, but so were the AAPs. What's different is we're elevating the level of performance in terms of how the farmers conduct their practices on their farms to a higher level. So they will even do a better job than they were doing under the AAPs, mitigating their impacts on the waters of the state.
Laura DiPietro, I'll come to you in just a moment, but just to get this semantic argument out of the way, if the AAPs were already required and the RAPs are required, I mean, it almost sounds like no change, and then the change is farmers who are already doing a good job are going to do an even better job. I mean, what's really at the crux of these changes? That small farms will be required to do these and there will be certification and enforcement? I mean, is that really the change?
Let me say the important point here is the RAPs are elevating the level of performance and practices on the farms as compared to the AAPs. But there are some definitely additional pieces, and I'll let Laura speak to those.
Yeah, the education is really the key component here. Is one of the requirements when you become a certified farm is you have to have required education courses. So it's that connectivity between the agency and knowing that these are rules that are in place and how to comply with them.
Okay. All right. So let me weigh in here and now and say, farmers, people who are listening who've been following Act 64, maybe you have what now is considered a small farm. You're interested in finding out about what kind of certification you'll need. This is the public comments period. We've caught Laura DiPietro and Chuck Ross in between two meetings here today where they're meeting with people about these new regulations, and this is a draft form. So we want to know what questions you have, if you've looked at these draft regulations, what works for you, what you think is really onerous. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So we've sort of talked about what the difference is, this elevation. What's the overall aim of having these anti-pollution measures for farms and agricultural practices?
Well, Jane, what we have come to understand ever more acutely is that we do have water quality problems in the state of Vermont. And there are many contributors to that problem, and it is historic in its genesis. We have all, as Vermonters, contributed to the problems we have now. Agriculture is one of many contributors to this issue, and these RAPs and the changes we're looking at through this process is an effort to help the farming community mitigate their impact on the waters of the state. It's important to understand that other contributors to the water quality problems are also having to make changes, whether it be wastewater treatment plants, municipalities and how they manage their roads, the development community in terms of what they do in terms of development, forestry. And then we also have to figure out how to deal with the stream bank erosion issues that have been increasing as a result of the changes in our climatic patterns here. So this is a significant effort that is the RAPs are focused on agriculture, but it's important to understand it's not just agriculture. When it comes to Lake Champlain, agriculture is 40% of the phosphorus problem. That means 60% comes from other sources in our society in Vermont.
Right, and they're being addressed in other places in Act 64,
correct,
including wastewater treatment plants, for example. These rules classify farms by size. Large farms have already had to be certified, as I understand it, under the AAPs. Small farms will now have to get certified. Can you break down what the difference is between a small farm and a large farm? And then these even smaller farms, which will now be under sort of the jurisdiction of local zoning.
Sure. So there are currently medium and large farms in the state. And if we talk about dairy, a medium farm is 200 to 699 mature animals, and large is 700 and up. And both of those size farms have a set of rules, and they are permitted under those rules. So there's an additional layer there. These AAPs that are now becoming the required ag practices do apply to all of those farms as well. But they also apply to small farms, and they are the predominant set of rules for the small farms. And the breakdown of what the legislature had asked is who should certify in that group. We basically looked at where we think the pollution sources may be coming from as far as the risk increasing as the farm grows in size. And so we've said, for using dairy again, anyone with 20 or more dairy cows would have to certify, which that certification, what it is, again, I mentioned the education, but it's also having a more solid plan for how you deal with your nutrients. It's getting an inspection so that you can understand where your farm may have deficiencies in complying with these rules. And it's just that opportunity, again, to go and get so many hours of credit and education so that you can go and do the practices as they fit on your farm. There is a group at the very, very bottom where we are proposing that local zoning could have control. And right now, the way that we've aligned that is there's a current zoning allotment that towns regulate the structures that are associated with certain animal types. So if you have three horses and you want to build a run-in shed for them, the town currently is the one where you would get a permit and you would have to meet their site restriction setbacks. And so they zone that structure. And what they don't have authority over right now, though, based on statute, is the activities associated with that structure. So where the manure is managed or other things like that. And so what we're proposing here is that same zoning definition that's been in place for many years would also allow the towns to have the authority to zone the activities. And then there's a group in between, and that group basically has to follow these rules, but they do not have to do the annual certification.
So that's for people who have, what, five horses, 10 cows, six chickens?
Yep. So four horses to 15 or 14 horses,
right,
I believe. But there's animal numbers for each type of animal that we would see in the state of Vermont.
So let's get into, for people who are saying, okay, I understand the concept. The idea here is you have to follow best practices and you're required to follow best practices to make sure that you're not getting, for example, more phosphorus into the water stream. But what exactly does that kind of practice mean? Let's just give examples for people, especially people who are maybe not farmers, because I imagine people who have farms are already looking at how to do this and are looking at what's going on their farm. Talk about manure regulations, manure spreading, for example.
Sure. So we're looking in this proposed draft to increase the spreading along floodplains as far as the regulatory oversight on that, finding better protections as far as setbacks so that during the shoulder seasons when the runoff and the flooding is most at risk and the water samples are showing that the results are higher as far as losses, to sort of limit the activity during those areas and during those times of years. But also where you store the manure, making sure that you have reasonable setback distances from surface waters or even swales that may lead to a surface water, so the conveyances. And then also protective grass measures, buffers, setbacks like that, where we would make sure that, you know, cover cropping occurs, people have permanent vegetation along waterways. And then on the pasture front where, you know, animals are making their own deposits, making sure that they're managed well so that the density of animals is controlled close to the stream so that it is not present there and is not likely to cause runoff issues.
So when we talk about things like the manure spreading, you're not supposed to spread on a field that is saturated or that's iced over and frozen.
Yep.
And that cover cropping, I mean, that is something that's going to be new for some small farms, that you should be putting in a cover crop in those shoulder seasons when you are close to a waterway, right?
Correct. We've seen a real transition in the amount of acreage in cover cropping. Last year, there was more than 20,000 acres that were cover cropped in the state. And I think when we started the program in 2007, we had, you know, a couple thousand. And so there's been real growth there. And for some small farms, it may be a change, but for others, they've already adopted it. And again, we're looking at trying to protect the areas that are most likely to have risk of runoff and losses of flooding, which are the floodplains, and putting it in there. Farmers may be required. They have choices, but under a nutrient management plan, one of the choices they can choose is to have a cover crop on upland areas, for instance. And so cover crop is a widely used practice more and more, and it is certainly one of the tools in the tool bag here.
And Jane, it's worth mentioning that a lot of the focus of the practices is to improve soil health and protect soil, which is really the fundamental asset on a farm. And when you improve soil health on a farm, you protect water quality, and when you do it right, you actually increase the productivity of your most basic asset, which is good for the farm. So there really is a way to have a win-win here, which is improve soil health, protect water quality, and improve your own productivity on your farm.
Because, Secretary Ross, you do want some phosphorus in the soil, especially if you're growing things in that soil, but there's a point at which too much phosphorus is not beneficial. And so you're talking about managing your farm and managing your practices so that it's beneficial for the farm and for our waterways.
Absolutely. The phosphorus is a critical nutrient to plant growth, but we have places where there's too much of it or where it migrates off the farm and into the waters, and that's what we're trying to prevent.
And then, Laura DiPietro, you mentioned, I loved your euphemistic expression, animals making their own deposits. But one of the things that we're trying to prevent here in these new rules would be, for example, animals that are allowed to wander freely in a stream, right?
Well, so what we're trying to do is find the balance. A number of years ago, I had done a study looking at livestock exclusion, and the cost of it could be $72 million. And, you know, certainly that's a significant cost. And at some point, your cost benefit degrades when the animals have access to potentially very, very small tributaries almost, and very thick overgrown areas. And so the access is not as extreme there as where it is where they might be congregating or might be fed over the winter. And so really trying to prioritize that where there's a production area or where animals are congregated, they need to be excluded versus where they are adequately pastured, there's sufficient growth in the pasture, there's not erosion on the stream, that is a well-managed situation that does not race high for the water quality issues as far as the cost benefit of where we need to go.
And that $72 million figure that you mentioned, that would be statewide for all farms to deal with this exclusion of animals in all of these very, very small waterways as well?
Yes, that's what we looked at. We tried to do our best understanding of, you know, all the four-legged animals that may have access and the type of fencing they may all need. And it did propose putting riparian forest buffers in there. So it is the higher number. The lower number was $33 million if we just did temporary fencing everywhere, like single-strand polyline.
We're talking about what farmers are going to have to do to keep up with new regulations relating to reducing phosphorus in our water bodies. Small farms will face stricter requirements by the summertime, and we're hearing about what exactly those entail. And if not stricter requirements, more enforcement, more certification. If you've got a question about the required agricultural practices, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at VPR.net. We're going to talk about what these changes will actually mean for farmers. Chuck Ross and Laura DiPietro have been talking to a lot of people around the state, and others in the Ag Agency as well have been doing this. So what are farmers telling them, and what changes might actually be made to these draft regulations? That's coming up. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Chuck Ross is the Secretary of the Vermont Agency of Agriculture. Laura DiPietro is Deputy Director of the agency's Agricultural Resource Management Division. They're helping us understand what new regulations directed at curbing pollution on farms might mean for small farms, which will be now subject to the enforcement of these rules. The Ag Agency is taking public comments on the draft. In fact, as we talk to them live during the noon hour, Ross and DiPietro are in between meetings in Montpelier and Randolph. You can call 1-800-639-2211 if you have a question about what the regulations entail or what you'd like to see changed, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Donald, who's calling in from Newport. Hi, Donald. Go right ahead.
Hi, everybody. Hope you're having a good day. So So I'm trying to understand something with the towns having the authority to zone if you have, like, two horses and whatnot, and what you would be considered as a small farmer. Because I guess the paper that I got the other day at the east side, we had a meeting over there, it says that if you own 10 acres, I mean, that eliminates right there your two head of beef or four chickens or whatever. You're, because of the acreage you own, that automatically bumps you up to needing a small farm certification. Am I understanding that correctly?
So the way we've proposed it is that the livestock numbers are tied to the acreage. So, for instance, if you only have two animals, even though you have the acreage, you do not bump up into that category. It's an and you have to meet both.
Okay. Donald, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, but I guess that's not what was on the paper that was in the handout, because in the small farm certification, you had your four categories, and then in each one of those categories was a criteria. If you met any one of them criteria, then that puts you in that category. So as I read it, it says if you have 10 acres, then that's what's going to put you in that, regardless of the number ahead of livestock that you had. And so I guess that beyond that, the only comment I would have was the meeting the other night, it was all the big boys there, you know, the large dairy farmers in Orleans County. You guys got to really get on the ball, because there's a ton of us out here, and, you know, there's nobody that has a clue that this is coming down the pipeline. And, you know, I think you folks, if you don't get your act together, it's going to be a big pushback. You know, the acreage thing in this is, you're fighting an uphill battle, and I know you got good intentions, but you've got to get a little bit more out there and get the smaller people involved in it if you want to get more info on it. So,
Donald, thanks for your comments.
I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I appreciate your comments and your perspective on this. Laura DePietro, can you just clarify again for Donald first this distinction between is it like an either or an and plus? And then we can, Chuck Ross, I mean, Donald is saying lots of small farmers not understanding these regulations and trying to be surprised, or are going to be surprised despite the ag agency's push to get out there and do this kind of education. So, Laura DePietro, let's start with you first.
Sure. In the Act 64, the legislature did give guidance and said that 10 acres or more used for farming should certify compliance with these rules. And so that is something that is in there. But what we've tied that to is and meets the animal numbers. And
okay.
So, for example, in certification for cows, it's 20 to 199 cows. And then there's an or, and this may be where the confusion comes in. It's or also they apply manure, compost, or other waste to their land. And that really is looking at people who don't have livestock of their own but may import waste, and saying that they're operating very similar to those that do have livestock and so also would be pulled in. And so it's 10 acres used for farming and the animal numbers, or applying manure or compost or other waste to those 10 acres.
Okay. All right. I think that's clear. Secretary Ross, what about what Donald said? You know, he was at a meeting, and it sounded from his comments like, you know, the really big farmers in the county were sort of sucking up all the air, and small farmers may not totally understand these regulations.
You know, that is a really interesting and important point, and a concern we've had from the outset, which is why we are actually out in the field having meetings with large groups of farmers and small groups of other of farmers and other stakeholders. We've been in since we first issued these rough draft, and I want to say rough draft, we've had over 20 meetings out in the community. So we have had actually quite a few small farm operators show up at these meetings, and we have been getting good input from them. But we understand we need to continue to do this work. This is round one. It's the rough draft stage. We'll have another round with another draft, and there'll be an opportunity for further public input. We urge people to look at these rules, and they have till the 18th. to offer comment on this particular draft, and then we'll have another comment period on the subsequent draft. And Jane, if I might, I think one of the things that people need to understand is this is a really important effort for water quality, but it's also an effort to make sure we can figure out and work with the farming community to enable them to continue to do what they do well in Vermont, which is be a part of our economy, our community, and our culture. And just a couple of stats to give people a sense of their importance. When we look at the farm and food system in the state of Vermont, from 2009 to 2014, that community of businesses and entrepreneurs have generated over 4,200 new jobs in the state of Vermont and established 655 net new businesses in the farm, ag, and food space. And they've increased their we've seen the increase in the gross state product of that they've contributed from $7.6 billion per year to over $10 billion per year. That's a very significant growth, way above what we see on average in the state of Vermont. So it's really imperative that we find a way to enable farmers to continue to do what they do so well in our communities and our economy while we help them mitigate their impact on the waters of the state. That's what we're trying to do here. And we need people's input to figure out how to do it well.
Well, I imagine you're also already getting pushback and anger from some people because we're hearing from it about it as well. Diane says, I think it's criminal that the Agency of Agriculture is requiring farmers to pay an annual permit fee to the tune of thousands of dollars to help fund new agency staff, not to help farmers implement projects. Farmers are experiencing low milk prices. I would like to get a reduction of 30% in income and then have to pay permits besides. This is an unfair burden to farmers. And Stephen operates a Royalton business that sells supplies and equipment to dairy farms. He also has four cows himself. He wrote to us to say, I'm going to work very hard to derail Act 64 in its current form. It's a stunning example of legislative and bureaucratic overreach. How it ever got this far, I'll never know, especially in Vermont. But truthfully, Vermont is well known for overregulating on farm food production. I've talked to many farmers about this, and they are not happy. Most didn't have a clue. I think it's a real example of the huge gap that exists between the farming and non-farming communities in the state. Many people in the non-farming community view farmers as people who never had the opportunity or ambition to improve themselves and thus should be treated and regulated like school children. So some real frustration, Secretary Ross.
Absolutely. We hear that. And that's one of the reasons why we actually built these draft rules with agriculture and farmer agriculture community and farmer input, and why we're out in the field trying to hear people from the get-go and get their input going forward. This says, unfortunately, there are people who have not heard about this effort, and that is something we're trying to overcome through this process. What we do need to understand, though, that there is a real water quality problem, and this is an issue that is confronting the state across the board and not just the agriculture community. So this is an effort to strike that right balance, and we are continuing to seek input on how these rules may be adjusted. And we're looking for input not only from large farmers, but we're looking for small farmers as well, and which is why we've been around the state, as I said before, over 20 meetings in the last month and a half.
And is there anything specific that you already know is changing from that first draft?
There were some requirements already in Act 64 that are in the law that we have to comply with. And so, for example, buffer setbacks of 25 feet from streams and 10 feet from ditches, that is something that's in the law that we're unable to change. The fact of the matter of annual certification by some group of farms, we get to define the group. But that process of certification, for instance, is also in the law. So there definitely are a few things that we can't change, but we're pretty clear when we're going out there and doing this roadshow of where we really need some input.
Like where?
So for instance, using the caller that said, or the writer that said that they had five animals and they're operating a farm themselves. For that person, just trying to get that educational concept that not much is going to change for them. They still have to follow the rules that they are basically following today with some minor additions. And so some of that is just making sure they keep records. You know, just not – we weren't explicit about it before. We're now being very explicit that we want to see the records. A few of the setbacks from surface water and wells for where they might store manure in an unimproved storage system is now pushed back to 200 feet, and that's something that's in law that we cannot change.
Wait, but those are things that are in the draft regulations. So what I'm asking is, from this public comment period, I understand that part of the purpose is educating farmers, but if part of the stated purpose is getting feedback so that things work better for farmers and you're willing to make changes, what changes do you think are actually going to come?
Yeah, so there's a few things that we put in there that we specifically were saying we want a feedback. So 10% slope manure applications with 100-foot setback, that's something we've gotten a lot of feedback on different practices that they could do instead of having one hard and fast that doesn't maybe work for everyone, as well as there's a soil test requirement that we've gotten a lot of feedback. Stacking manure and where it is required to be stacked and how they manage it, we've gotten a lot of feedback on. So there's definitely some really good input that we've gotten that we will adapt in this next draft.
Secretary Ross, is there money for farms that might struggle to get up to spec when these new regulations actually go into practice? Because it may cost some farms, and especially some small farms that might have a smaller financial buffer, some money to get those riparian buffers or to get the cover crop or to make sure they're changing their manure spreading practices. So are there funds out there?
Yes, and that goes to one of the questions I think a woman wrote in on, which is the cost of this. And what we have done in the last couple of years is assemble an array of resources above and beyond what has been on the table before. And it measures and the following amounts. Over $60 million of federal money is targeted to the water quality issues. That'd be $45 million of EQIP money through NRCS, $16 million of federal money through the RCPP grant, matched by $20 million of Vermonter match contributions. In addition to that, the state has established a clean water fund that's estimated to generate about $10 million a year that will be applied to not only agriculture but the other sectors of the society, like municipalities, helping municipalities. And then there's the ongoing agency budgets. And these are funds that are available to help farmers implement these changes that will help them mitigate their impact on the waters of the state. And we have a whole array of partners who are working with us to help those farmers understand how to access those funds.
Well, and again, this is a draft of a draft, more to come, and certainly more to come on Vermont Edition as this moves forward over the next several months. Chuck Ross is Secretary of the Vermont Agency of Agriculture. Laura DiPietro is Deputy Director of the agency's Agricultural Resource Management Division. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the audacity of hoop. That's the title of Sports Illustrated senior writer Alex Wolf's new book. It's all about the influence basketball has had on Barack Obama and the way he operates as president. That's next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Sports Illustrated senior writer and Cornwall resident Alexander Wolf says basketball shaped the character of our current president, Barack Obama, and that the game is deeply connected to his time in the country's top office. Wolf found so many connections that he wrote a book about them. It's called The Audacity of Hoop: Basketball and the Age of Obama. Written by Wolf, the book is also chock full of photographs of Obama and others in action. When I spoke with Alex Wolf about the book, he said Obama's love of the game was well known among the presidential candidate's strategic team in 2008, and it didn't take long before the American electorate knew, too.
Certainly in New Hampshire, where you have to do a lot of retail campaigning, David Axelrod told me that they wanted to get him out of those kind of formal stump speech situations and get him a little closer, more on the ground. So somebody else in the campaign, his director for New Hampshire, said, how about basketball? Because we can play these games early in the day. It's hard to get exercise in these long campaign days anyway. So they played with patrolmen. They played with firefighters. And he didn't have to be persuaded to do it. The calculation that they made in New Hampshire was, well, we don't want him playing basketball too quickly before people really know who he is, because it would play into a stereotype. Axelrod actually was very explicit about that. And he has a track record of introducing black candidates to white electorates. But they seem to have found just the right time to do it. And then there's the famous moment in Kuwait when he's visiting the troops and he just jacks up a three-pointer on a whim while he's wearing street shoes and he's wired for sound, and the thing goes in, and it played into this narrative that the guy had the magic touch. But yeah, so this is the game that he takes into the Oval Office, and that actually is where my interest came in. I was asked after he was elected in 08, before the inauguration in January of 09, is to kind of look at basketball's role in the making of this guy.
Asked by Sports Illustrated?
By Sports Illustrated, yeah, to do this piece. And in poking around, it occurred to me, I wonder what's going to happen once he actually takes the oath of office. Is the game going to continue to be there? There was talk about he was going to rip out the bowling alley from the White House and put in an indoor court. He didn't do that, but he did retrofit the tennis court into a basketball court outdoors. And come to find out, there were lots of instances where basketball figured in governing and getting what he wanted. And then the photographs started to come out of the White House Flickr feed, where Pete Souza, the official White House photographer, was taking a lot of moody, intimate pictures of him either playing or around the game or around ball players. And that was when I thought, oh, there is a book here. There's text and there's photographs.
You say that basketball played into the way he governs. Can you give me an example of that?
The example that I wasn't fully aware of until I started to burrow into it, that I think is probably the most meaningful, was you recall when healthcare.gov goes online and it's just a disaster of a rollout. And the pundits in D.C. were all saying, there's no way they're going to make the signups. They had to get 10 million people to sign up and had to get a lot of young people to sign up in order to make those exchanges work. And there was this critical signup period from October to March. And it so happened that's precisely when the NBA season takes place. And Obama began to call in favors. And he got Alonzo Mourning, who'd come back with a kidney transplant, Magic Johnson, HIV positive, do these very powerful public service announcements. Kobe Bryant, LeBron James start tweeting out using social media saying, you really ought to do this. You really ought to get covered. It's important. And they bought time on NBA TV, TNT, all these channels where they could reach these audiences that they needed. They needed young people. They need ethnically diverse people, the basketball demographic. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that basketball saved Obamacare, but there's no question that it played a role.
Do you think, though, it's a stretch? I mean, this is a book whose whole thesis is basketball and Obama, and basketball shaped Obama, basketball shaped the presidency. It's his common language with the American people. Is it a stretch? I mean, are you sort of stretching for these examples, or do you think it really is sort of a key feature of how he thinks and how he works with America?
I think if you play the parlor game and you try to extrapolate metaphorically, you can go too far, no question. Foreign policy-wise, because we're not in a bipolar world anymore, you have to cobble together these kind of nonce alliances as you do with pickup ball. The person who's your opponent this moment might be your ally the next. Maybe that is a stretch, but it's a challenging and fun way to engage with this presidency. I do think where there's no question that projecting who he is to voters by filling out his bracket every March in the NCAA tournament, the way during the 08 campaign he did use the game on the stump. I mean, there's youth, there's vitality. Really, he's the first president since the Kennedys, really, since JFK, with a young family. And he played with his daughters. He coached Sasha's youth league team. And some of the pictures in the book that I love the most are ones that have that old Life magazine, JFK Camelot, you know, John and Caroline under the desk in the Oval look to them, but he's playing ball with them. So I think certainly on the personal, getting to see who he really is, I think it's legit. Maybe some of these extrapolations I stretched a bit.
You know, the irony here, or maybe the interesting part of this, or maybe it all actually fits together perfectly, is that he was never a great
player, certainly not a great formal player. He did play high school ball at Punahou, his high school in Hawaii, but he rode the bench despite asking the coach for more playing time. And then he didn't play formally in college. So he really honed his skills in the pickup games. And he's a pickup player. And in fact, you say he's really good at playing with players who are better than he is.
Yeah, he's become that. And that to me is an underrated storyline here, that he's this self-taught player. And it wasn't that he wasn't good enough to play in high school. He was stuck on a really good team. This was a team really for the books, for the ages in Hawaii high school basketball. So he would have started at any other high school in the state. But this guy who was too wild really to be tamed by his coach as a high schooler then is suddenly around Arnie Duncan, who was a co-captain at Harvard, John Rogers and Barack Obama's brother-in-law, Craig Robinson, both played at Princeton. A number of very good Division III players become good friends in Chicago. So he's playing with these guys. And indeed, he is becoming that probably the least accomplished player among many, but finds this way to support, to fit in. And I am struck, and I do think there's a legitimacy to this extrapolation, that's a little bit like what a president has to do. You know, you have experts around you, people who know more than you do, and you collect and you analyze and you process. And that's very Obama-esque.
In this book, you have these incredible photographs. Many of them are from Pete Souza, the official White House photographer. How did you get those photos?
Well, you and I and all of our listeners today help pay Pete Souza's salary as taxpayers. So his pictures are free to use in editorial contexts. And these photos were taken. They get pushed out on the White House Flickr feed. And while I didn't get a one-on-one interview with the president for the book, the photo office and Pete were given instructions to cooperate where they could. The biggest get was I knew that there were pictures of him playing with his daughters, and I asked Pete about it, and they're very reluctant to release any photos of the girls for good reasons. But he said he would check and was able to get permission. So we have two of those.
Yeah, one where they're all taking a shot, and the other one I think is when they're all dribbling down the court.
They're all dribbling down the court, and the one of them dribbling down the court to me is a really powerful and meaningful picture if you know a little bit about Obama's backstory. Obama has said that one of the reasons he had this undomesticated game and didn't play a lot in high school, now that he looks back with some objectivity, is that he didn't have a dad around who would take him out to the park and work on his offhand. So he was a very left-handed player. Well, that photograph of him dribbling with his daughters, they're all dribbling with their right hand, which is Obama's offhand. So he's taking very seriously his paternal duties to make sure that his offspring can dribble with both hands.
Are they both left-handed?
That I don't know.
So they may be with dominant hand, but at least he's
working.
Role modeling. He's modeling to keep practicing with your offhand.
And yes, and he does need to work on his right hand, even at his advanced age. And he'd be the first person to admit it.
Do you know if the president has looked at the book, has seen it?
You know, I sent a copy to Pete Souza because I felt very strongly that here's a guy who's taken so many of these great pictures and he has no real control over how I'm going to use them. And when he sent me his mailing address, he said, you might want to enclose another copy for my boss, which I'd been planning to do anyway. And I did hear back that he had actually gotten his copy and really liked it and was sharing it was some aides that morning, including Susan Rice. There's a picture of his national security advisor as a high school basketball player. So he was meeting with her and a few other national security aides and was showing them all this picture of Susan Rice as a high school star.
Well, the book is called The Audacity of Hoop, Basketball, and the Age of Obama. It's by Alexander Wolf. Alex, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Jane.
And that'll wrap up today's show. Tomorrow, Senate President John Campbell will be talking about the Medicaid shortfall, possible changes to the spending caps of Act 46, gun control initiatives, and the paid sick leave bill. So be sure to tune in live tomorrow at noon. And next Friday, the 18th, is our annual music show. Tell us what you think is the best song of 2015 and a little bit of what you like about it. We'll try to play some of it on the show. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net and be sure to tune in for that show. It's always a fan favorite next Friday. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the program and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening. Thank you.